There's a lot of secrecy around what I'm selling so you don't sell it also and compete with me. And I really didn't feel like it needed to be that way. So I was like, let me create a community and kind of lead by example. I help you out. And in return, when you discover new creative things that can help you grow your business, you'll do that in turn.
Welcome to the B2B Breakthrough Podcast. We're here to bring you all the best knowledge, insights, and strategies from e-commerce experts, successful business owners, and the team at Alibaba.com that you'll need to grow your business and achieve your next big breakthrough. I'm your host, Sharon Guy. Welcome to today's episode, where we're joined by Carlos Alberto Alvarez, the founder and CMO of Wizards of Ecom, an e-commerce academy based in Miami dedicated to empowering and educating sellers on Amazon. With over 15 years of experience selling on Amazon and growing his own brands to nine figures in gross revenues, Carlos is an avid meetup organizer, sharing his wealth of knowledge and fostering a supportive environment with the model hashtag sellers helping sellers. So welcome to our show, Carlos.
Thank you so much.
So maybe let's start in your own beginnings. I mean, nine figures is a formidable figure. It probably didn't occur overnight. How was that journey, or how did you get into this whole space?
I was working a lot of full-time jobs. I didn't make it very far in school, and I found myself as a young adult, maybe like my late 20s, early 30s, and everyone around me that, you know, I guess paid better attention in school and dedicated themselves were much further ahead of me. I was working at a supermarket. I was delivering subs. I was selling cigars.
Great variety.
Yeah. And it motivated me to constantly look for different side hustles or things that I could do to make money outside of that job. So it doesn't take that many side hustles to make more than you would as a dairy clerk in a supermarket. So very quickly, I started dropping these other jobs and I discovered eBay. I think this is like 16 years ago. And then I started putting all my eggs into eBay, and I would just find products at local garage sales. And then with the profits, I would turn to, I don't know if it's early days Alibaba, but for me, it was like my early days Alibaba, to find random products that I could get at pennies on the dollar and then bring to the United States and flip. And I kept doing that. And then I ran into a big problem with one of my products, almost lost it all, and pivot into a very strange business, you would say, breeding and selling live insects online. And
wait, let's dissect that a little bit. So first of all, in your early eBay days, you were going to garage sales and flea markets and discovering one-off items. And I guess noticing that this probably can sell for much more than what I'm buying it for. And was there a certain category that you focused on, certain vibe or type of product?
No, anything legal that I could buy low, sell high. That was it. And had the least amount of effort to it is what I was focusing on. When you have almost nothing, it was very easy to, you know, flip used books in the beginning. And then once I got a little bit of capital, it was scratch and dents, anything I can get a hold of. And then on Alibaba, it was more into the, I guess you would say, health and personal care.
Health supplements or dumbbells for working out?
Health for adults.
Like sexual health pieces of hardware?
Yes, I didn't know what we could say on the show. So it was adult novelty products.
In my opinion, a product is a product, and healthcare is very 360 degrees, every different types of facet. Sexual health is a very important part of our healthcare in general.
That's what it was. It was that category. It was just things you could get for pennies on the dollar. You buy something for 16 cents and sell it for like 30 bucks. And I was like, okay, well, that's where I need to be.
In that space, do you know this company called Adam and Eve or Dame?
Very well.
Were they your early competitors?
Early competitors in the sense of like a dragon to a gnat.
Did you ever think about building your own brand at that point and just honing into that space?
No, it wasn't until the first business that I exit, which ends up being the insect one, that I was like, okay, I don't want to be broke. I also don't want to be running around constantly looking for the next thing I could flip. And I wasn't even calling it a brand. I was like my own thing. But that was my first instance with brand. So at this point, no, I'm not thinking about my own brand.
And what is the thing with the insects part?
I was breeding them and selling them online, and there was very few people doing it at the time.
Still on eBay.
eBay, and then we were getting approached on, like every time I would do an auction on eBay for say 1,000 crickets, I would get reached out to by Amazon, and they would say, you need to come try our platform and try this FBA thing.
But how do you do that for live products? Do they allow that?
No, there's not. It would be 100% FBM. It was just, I think in earlier days, Amazon, I guess they were doing a lot of things that they would suspend somebody for now if they tried to do, but they were reaching out on eBay's platform to eBay sellers and trying to attract them over to Amazon. And they weren't really paying attention to what they were selling. It was just like this mass copy paste thing. So I fell into that. And that's how I started hearing about Amazon and FBA. And since I was also reselling other things, it was like, oh, well, maybe these things that don't sell well, maybe I'll just send them to FBA and get them out of my house.
I see. But who is on your buying side? Who is buying all these insects?
That's an excellent question. But what I thought it was nothing but somebody who owns like a bearded dragon or a small snake, different reptiles, and they needed food to feed them. But I started seeing larger orders and I'm like, why is somebody ordering 10, 15, 20,000 of these things, 100,000? And when we used to be able to see the name and address and everything of where the product was being shipped to, I would just do a Google Earth search and I'd see that it was poultry farmers that were buying these things in bulk. So that had me pivot a lot of the business at that time.
Okay. So that business was going well.
That business was going really good. And I get approached one day, I made an offer to sell it. And one of those, they want to purchase my business or acquire my business. And it was something that ended with an M, like $1 million. And I was like, oh my God, something that I created that I really didn't even know if it was doing well. Somebody wants to buy from me for over $1 million. So that was like a hindsight, the deal wasn't good, but it was like the best thing for me at the time. And it was like very validating to know like, oh, wow, I created something that somebody else finds valuable and they actually know business. So I exited, but not knowing how to handle money and being that young, it wasn't like an amount of money that I could just retire for the rest of my life.
How did you even get to know that know-how? Does your background come from agriculture, horticulture?
Friends and family saw that I was starting to be entrepreneurial and that I was quitting these jobs and I was now doing this full time. So they pulled together $81,000 and I decided to go all in on my product that had the highest profit margin. And I contact the person I'm purchasing from and they said, well, you know, there's lead times and there's all this other stuff that very obviously is involved with an order of that size. And in my ignorance, I didn't understand that. So I quickly started looking for another supplier and one just popped up and they just said, yes, everything was perfect. They had everything I needed on hand. I just needed to pay them and get it shipped. So a simple Google search would have shown that they weren't a real factory. It was like, it was a sucker born every minute and I was the sucker in that instance. And I just send the money to this person and they stole it all. So I didn't want my friends and family to know that Carlos had screwed up again and I lost the money. So I started getting the little personal belongings that I had to sell them. And two of those things were snakes. I did like reptiles. And I had a Burmese python and a Colombian red tail boa. I go into a pet shop to sell them. And the person in front of me was paying like $25 for 50 live worms. And I was like, wait a minute, I'll dig for these things. Like I work hard. So then I started researching about it. And that's what led into, which by the way, is an extremely hard business. And I don't recommend anybody to do it. But that's what led me into that.
The insect growing business.
Oh yeah. It's very difficult.
Do you have a backyard? Like, do you have the whole facility? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine sort of a insect grower's life and setup.
At this stage, it's about 40,000 square feet of warehouse space that makes up the farms. So it's definitely way beyond just a house. Last year alone, we did about $90 million in gross sales on live insects. So it's way beyond like a garage hobby.
So was that your nine-figure business?
No. Since I had that business acquired, I've successfully started and exited 17 more brands. The current brand I have now, ironically, the only one I have left, is a live insect business because when my non-compete ended, I had started it again. So it's sort of full circle. So yeah, I just exited three of my brands, left with the five insect. That was the nine figures.
So my little bit of work with the insect space is when I worked with this brand called Sifu Foods. I think they're gone by now. I'm not sure, but I was a marketing consultant for them and they would turn insect into food. So there's a whole thing with eating more bugs. First of all, it's higher in protein than the beefs and the chickens. Also, it's better for the planet growing a bug versus growing a whole cow. The CO2 emissions that come from that, it's better for the planet. And then from a profit perspective, it's also very profitable. But at the same time, the end consumer, you know, you kind of think, ew, it's a bug. I don't want to eat that. It looks like a bug. So these guys would ground them up into flour and that flour then be used for cookies, for any type of baking need. I mean, it's sort of like an added protein powder.
You're spot on. So the majority of our sales to date is still selling to those reptile owners and poultry farmers and different farmers. But part of the business, though, that has the most gross potential is in the food space. So we've gotten into the refinement of certain of these insects to be used as protein sources, whether it's for supplements, breads, flours, cookies, like whatever the case may be. And I don't know how far I could take that. It does seem like it's growing into like a multi-billion dollar industry, but the people that are involved in that space have endless budgets. And that's why I think now is about the time for me to look to do another exit.
But also that industry isn't exactly taking off, because this project I think I did maybe 10 years ago now. And at that time, it seemed very innovative. A lot of people were jumping in because this alternative food source or alternative protein space had its up. And then now I kind of feel like things are a little stagnant. What are your thoughts?
I don't know that I disagree. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think something unique about this industry, though, is that while it does seem a little stagnant now, I think it's impossible for just earth and protein to not go that route. I've never ate a bug, by the way, but the science behind it is pound for pound, the best protein source on earth, the carbon footprint, everything that you said. I find it impossible that it's not going to go that way. And I think the stagnation may have to do more with no one wants to know that cricket is in their bread, for an example. Anybody that's had like this super protein bread or super protein powder probably has, because it doesn't say cricket, it's got some other name.
Yeah, I think so much of that is the marketing aspect. It's still very, very counter to our culture, at least general American culture, to be eating bugs, even though a lot of other cultures around the world actually do eat them on the daily. And it's very healthy. And we could also run into a food source problem for the whole world by the year 2050, I think. It's the speed with which we're consuming nowadays and the supply, it's not meeting our demand. And so that's why also other scientists trying to go into the bug space. But I think the overall industry, that marketing piece is really hard to re-educate that consumer. So shifting gears a little bit to Wizards of Ecom, how did you start to build that out? Or what was the thought behind building up a platform like that?
So about 11, 12 years ago, I used to meet with a group of friends. We try weekly and just talk shop. And we all had our different reasons for selling in e-commerce. Mine was just at the early stages was work for myself and be able to really buy what I want from the supermarket without being concerned on price. Other people was real estate or whatever. And we kept meeting, but then with a small circle of people, I feel like it turns into this fishing story. Like I did X amount of sales and the next person needs to beat that number. And it got stale. And I felt that we needed to get new ideas into it. And I, with growing brands or the brands I had started to date, I think it's extremely important to grow a community, build an email list before you launch those brands. So I had experience creating a meetup group on meetup.com in the scuba space so that I could start a scuba brand, in the pet space so I could start a pet grooming brand. So one of my friends is like, why don't you create a meetup group about selling on Amazon, which Amazon had pretty much dominated the conversation at that point over eBay. And I was like, okay, I don't think anyone's going to show. But I created it at a Starbucks near my house thinking, you know, if nobody shows, at least it's not a long drive. Four people showed up. The next four events, I think nobody showed up. And I used to take a picture of like the people in the table behind me. I'd like catch them in a selfie and say, I look forward to seeing everybody in the next event. So it looked like people showed. And then little by little, people started coming in and it's grown to the largest thing of its kind in the world today. The motivation was it was very difficult doing stuff alone. It was very difficult to get fresh ideas. And in the e-com space, there's a lot of secrecy around like what I'm selling so you don't sell it also and compete with me. And I really didn't feel like it needed to be that way. So I was like, let me create a community and kind of lead by example there, not charge anybody. It's free. I help you out. And in return, when you discover new creative things that can help you grow your business, you'll do that in turn. And it wasn't always smooth, but I feel like we definitely accomplished that.
So is it still a free platform for anyone to join?
It is. All the meetups are 100% free to attend in person. They're 100% free to watch on the stream. What I needed to do at some point, though, especially having all these different physical locations, was where we have our meets, there needs to be some kind of economics behind it if you want to keep giving value. So we have an optional, if you want to watch the recordings of our past classes or workshops, there's like a $50 a month membership to be able to do that. And then we've been able to, I'd say, strategically partner with some brands as sponsors like Alibaba, someone that's morally and ethically aligned with what we believe in. And they're not going to ask something of us that is not sellers helping sellers, that's going to come at the detriment of sellers in our community, business owners in our community. And I really feel that, not just because I'm on this podcast, I'm very team Alibaba anyway, but Alibaba's one thing throughout the years, no matter what's changed, has always been like what we're about is, in my opinion, you correct me if I'm wrong, but they're very about like, we want to help businesses and brands do better. And the better they do, the more business they can do. So I feel like it's in their best interest for that to happen. That's very hard to find, though. It's very easy to find people that say, yeah, I want to be a sponsor and get my brand in front of your community. It's very difficult to find someone, though, that is morally and ethically aligned like Alibaba. So a combination of those recordings and strategic sponsorships, and we've been able to pull it off.
I think incentives are aligned, right? The way that Alibaba is set up. If the more a seller is using the platform, the more Alibaba.com is generating revenue. And when Jack Ma, the founder, set out to found the company, his whole thing was to enable sellers to do business anywhere or more easily. And that's always been his motto. And that's been the motto of the whole company, no matter what other future fintech product it created, cloud product it later created, and all of that. So seems like Wizards of Ecom is similar. What is this PI wholesale hybrid model? Is that part of the workshop teachings?
PL wholesale hybrid model is, there's a whole bunch of different models to that someone can approach for selling online. Like I mentioned earlier, I used to resell Adam and Eve, asked about starting my own brand. So that would be more of private label. And this is one of the things I feel like Co-Create is going to be awesome for, is like teaching people how to like be smart about logistics. And one of the things that's happened though, is since there is a lot of ignorance around the logistics issue, is finding a product is very easy to do on Alibaba. Finding a supplier that can make that product is very easy. Getting that product over here and into a customer's hands and remaining profitable is challenging. There's still a lot there. So that challenge translates into the barrier of entry, the dollar entry amount to start selling your own brand private labels, much higher than what it was 15 years ago. And there's a lot of other parts that are involved. So the PL wholesale hybrid model is a way of kind of getting the best of both worlds. I'm scared to use the Adam and Eve example, but like say you sold a lubricant and you also had this product that you're selling from Adam and Eve, that would be a perfect combination. So if you were partnering with Adam and Eve, they have their product, you're having their name in the title of your product listing. So you're leveraging that existing search that's for it, that brand, that social proof, but then you also have your own branded lubricant that's with it, that if it was a standalone listing would not have that social proof. So it's a way of getting the leverage of an existing brand and jumpstarting your own brand. And it also just means that the dollar amount barrier of entry of starting to sell is much lower.
I want to take a minute to talk about Alibaba Guaranteed. Sourcing can be long and complicated, but we're making it as easy as everyday online shopping with Alibaba Guaranteed, a selection of stock and customizable products with on-time delivery and money back for order issues, all guaranteed by Alibaba.com. With Alibaba Guaranteed, you can source with added confidence. You'll find products at competitive wholesale prices, and you can enjoy peace of mind knowing your delivery will arrive on time by the guaranteed dates. Should any issues arise with your orders or product quality, you're covered with a comprehensive money-back guarantee. Search for Alibaba Guaranteed to start sourcing more simply and achieve your next big breakthrough. As you're piggybacking off of all this brand equity that another brand had created and using their marketing dollars and sort of brings you in, what does the PI stand for then?
Private label.
What is your strategy in finding products to sell?
I like to find products that I'm passionate about or would like to be passionate about. So one example would be, and I'm not going to do this one because I recommended it to a friend of mine. He's taken off and done amazing with starting a brand called Leaves and Soul. But what you're passionate about, I feel like is self-explanatory. But what you would like to be passionate about is what I'm going to describe. And that is, I work a lot, so I'm always stressed. Doctor said, you need to get a hobby. Well, the thing is, every time I get a hobby, I try to turn it into a business. And I was like, what is the most zen-like hobby that I could think of that I could get into? Since I like gardening, I was like, bonsai. So I don't know anything about bonsai, but me just saying that, I feel like I could get passionate about liking bonsai. So it needs to be something I'm passionate about or something I'd like to be passionate about that makes me want to be excited and get up in the morning and learn more about.
You're going back to the growing something live category again.
Yeah, even if that box is checked, I like to make sure that there is a lot of content around the product. So I have a very content-first approach, which ties into community. And that is, are people asking a lot of questions about this product? And is the competition in delivering those answers, whether it's a podcast, YouTube, Google SEO, whatever the case may be, is the competition there something that I can compete on? There's no point in me building an email list full of people if I don't have cool stuff that I can share with them. And that's content. So I like to make sure that it's a content-rich niche. And then I look at what are some of the best sellers in this category and can I do better? So this is where I have ideas, but I don't know how grounded in reality they are. I'll go on Alibaba. I'll find some factories. I'll surface some factories with like the RFQ, request for quotation. And then I will narrow it down to my dream suppliers, if you will. And then I'll talk to them. I'll be like, you guys have the experience in this. This is my idea. This is the space I want to be in. I want to have something that is aesthetically different. Because selling online, I feel like using a, let's say a coffee grinder. If you have a coffee grinder and you change an inner mechanism of this coffee grinder, that is not visually apparent when you're looking at this product from the outside. So it's very difficult to communicate the value of that product in the main image of a listing. That's what you're selling online. So I was like, I need to do something that is adding value to this product and that is visually, aesthetically pleasing from the outside of this product, and just brainstorm with them. And some of the coolest ideas I've launched and made a ton of money on were just brainstorm sessions with expert suppliers that I met through Alibaba. So that's where I go. And I'm like, okay, let's test this now. And those are my main steps. There's a few other ones and I could really nerd out about it, but those are the main ones that if those boxes are checked, I'm going to go through with the product.
And these are suppliers that you're finding from Alibaba.com that you're then pulling to do a Zoom call session with, or you're just calling them up on the phone?
At first, it's back and forth. It used to be QQ, now it's like WeChat, but wherever it's most comfortable to do. It's more difficult when I first started to get them to commit to like a video call and a lot of their time if I've not proven that I'm serious about doing business. Like I can imagine some of these suppliers must get inundated with
requests and inquiries.
Right. And not all of them are serious. So as I started, kind of like a hack, if you will, that I do now is I've gone to so many weddings of my suppliers in China and they've come to mine that at this point I could just say, hey, so-and-so, I'm thinking of working with this other factory on this unrelated thing. I don't want them to think I'm one of a bazillion people in their inbox. Do you mind just calling them? Almost like a referral. And I'll have enough people call from the beginning. I don't want to say that suppliers don't take you serious in the beginning, but there definitely is a difference when you have referrals. I think that's just human nature.
Also, it's one supplier telling another one. So why wouldn't you pay attention to that guy?
Right. He has spent X amount of dollars with us over X amount of time. I think maybe you should pay attention. So when I do that, I think it would be an ego problem to say that I know better on how to change or evolve this product over a factory that has probably done this a million times. So I definitely lean on their expertise more than mine when it comes to that. And again, some of the greatest ideas I've had for products have come that way.
Most likely, they also have this product probably selling on a Chinese e-commerce platform where there are millions more of comments, changes for features, messages that come from Taobao's chat infusing that product owner or that factory owner. How else, other than attending their weddings, have you been able to successfully build out your relationships with these suppliers?
No one's ever asked me that. So like one of the ways that I think is really underrated that I wish more people would do this is like, I'm going to just use a request for quotation as an example, but you could even just manually reach out. But like, it usually starts with this vomiting of outreach to a whole bunch of people or reaching out to you. You find one and you ignore the rest. I don't ignore them. I follow through and just let them know like, hey, look, we've decided to go with such and such because of blank. I'm not trying to negotiate on this. I just want to give you an update that we close this out. I've really enjoyed whatever back and forth we have had. If there's anything that I can do on my end, maybe act as a referral or connect you with somebody, like we don't have to like not talk to each other. And I'm just raising my hand and kind of saying like, hey, I'm here for that. A lot of really good referrals have come from, and connections or ideas have come from people that I decided not to work with, but we just kept the conversation open. So many that I feel like it's worth mentioning. This is a hard one for my community because I talk so much about it that it almost sounds like I'm saying the only way to have a successful brand is to go to China. You don't have to go, but yes, going, it helps a lot. Again, just human nature, but going there, visiting the factory, getting to know everybody there, I think goes a long way and not enough people do it.
Because you run a community and because I think I've heard multiple data points that going to China is a good idea. Have you held these sort of China tours where you assemble a bunch of sellers and then do like a 10-day, 20-day trip?
Not since COVID. They're usually 21 to 30 days or right under 30 days. It was pre-COVID. We were going to do another one last October, but we had a lot of other stuff going on and we didn't, but we totally did. And we center it around the Canton Fair. But when we were there, we would go to Hong Kong Mega, we would go to Cross Border Summit. Between phases at the Canton Fair, I would emphasize striking that relation up while you're at the Canton Fair, and then during the break between phases, going to go visit, best ways to navigate, having people come visit you at your hotel, and you know, the coffee shop. But we used to do that.
Is the Cross Border Summit the one with Mike Michelini?
Yeah, I don't know if he's still doing it, but yes, Michelini's amazing.
He is doing it. You're friends with him?
Yeah, we are. He's amazing.
He's really great. I think his vibe is very similar to yours, where I feel like both of you believe in, I'm in the speaker space and we talk about this thing called abundant generosity, that if the only way to make the pie bigger is just to bake a bigger pie instead of like it's always a zero-sum game. But he gives off that vibe too. He moved to Chiang Mai. And so now his summit is in Chiang Mai now, I think, every November. So you have obviously seen amazing success in Amazon, and then you started to branch out to other platforms. Can you tell us what they are and what have you seen on the other platforms?
We've done Overstock.com, we've done Walmart, we've done eBay, we've done big box retail stores, like pretty much the normal culprits. And I would say a regret is that I didn't do it quicker and that I haven't been more aggressive about it than I have. I think the reason is because I would be in all these different spots, and there was a period of time that even if you added them all together, they were still such a small percentage to the behemoth that was selling on Amazon. So easy to get complacent and you're like, I can only deploy X amount of dollars in resources to market something. Like, well, you're going to put the majority in where the majority of money's coming from. And I don't know that I was wrong, but fast forward to nowadays, not having, you know, the rising cost of pay-per-click advertising on Amazon is just making it to where most of the products I know people sold 7 years and later ago could not even be profitable right now, like because of the way advertising is.
Because it's too saturated.
Way too saturated in the cost. It's very pay to play. Like you have a great product, it doesn't mean anything. It needs to get seen and you're going to have to do paid ads. So if you're not multi-channel, then you're probably not paying attention to things like external ads. You're not paying attention to email lists, your own D2C website. You're probably neglecting partnerships, PR, like so many other things that are important to running a business. And I just can't emphasize it enough. Advertising on all these platforms is never going to go down. And that is coming directly out of your profit margin in a product, which is why we're doing this. Or even if it's to save the world, you need the profits. Like I was saying with Wizards of Ecom, I want it to remain 100% free, but if I didn't have a paid membership to watch the recordings of the classes, we wouldn't be able to operate. So you have to be able to have profits in your business. And the current state of Amazon right now, it's dicey. If somebody's just selling on Amazon, and the reason I'm saying Amazon, just because it's majority of the conversation, you have a very unhealthy business model and you're like one email away from being shut down.
Is there a formula that a brand can follow if they want to not put all their eggs in one basket in Amazon?
Tooting my own horn here, I think it's the way that I go about sourcing products is, for example, selling on TikTok right now is absolutely amazing.
And you started doing that?
Yes. So in a percentage of TikTok shop sales, some people just look at it and they're like, you know, I don't want to wait 6 to 8 days to receive this. They jump over to Amazon and they buy it. So you see a lift just by being on TikTok of like 15% plus. So I feel like if you need to know this when you're sourcing the product, if you're sourcing a product that doesn't allow for the creation of content, well, you know what? It's going to be very difficult to create advertising. It's going to be very difficult for that influencer using TikTok as an example to create something amazing out of your garlic press. The only place that garlic press could have sold was on Amazon, and the time where you could have properly done that has passed. So how you source your products, you need to think about how they would look on these other platforms, what kind of content you could create behind them, who are the influencers that are attached to them. And if you can't answer one of those, then it's probably a really bad product.
Do you live stream?
Oh yeah. I did amazing with Amazon live streams, and I'm hoping it starts catching on like the way it does on Taobao and everywhere else. But I suspect it's only a matter of time before that starts happening in the US like that.
Poshmark is a popular one for selling clothing or anything used. And then the other one is called Whatnot.
Whatnot's really known for like trading cards and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's pretty amazing what Whatnot's going on. So the Miami, Florida location of Wizards of Ecom, we're about to move to a much, much bigger location. And one of the dedicated areas we're having in that bigger location, I was just talking to the team yesterday about it, is going to be for live streaming. So like I really feel that bullish on that. That's going to be that important.
And I'm a TikTok user, and every 4 or 5 videos, is a streaming session. They're just shooing massive amounts of traffic into live stream rooms. And these are products that I am absolutely not interested in buying, but they're still pushing eyeballs to the rooms.
So what do you think, though? You think live selling or, you know, social selling, I guess you'd call it, you see that growing more in the US now, or we've kind of hit the peak?
So it depends on what you're selling, I think. The Amazon Lives back in the day, they're very professionally done videos and studios. It's sort of on another level. And so I think it's really intimidating for an average seller to start turning on their camera and talking about a product. Whereas I see the Poshmarks and whatnots to be a lot more easier for sellers to get started, as well as TikTok. So the barrier for entry is a bit lower. And I think it's a mixed bag in terms of successes. But technically, the live streaming market in the US is already $40 billion, I think is the figure. So it's happening. It's just very separated in many, many different platforms. Whereas in China, it's all majority concentrated on Taobao. Now you have the Douyin and the Kuaishou, and all of these other platforms have started the live streaming trend. But even so, there's a lot fewer platforms in China than the US. And so that's where there's no consolidation happening. And so that's why you can't see these large figures. You have to look at it from an industry as a whole. And I think the way that the US consumer buys something, it's very D2C or it's very website heavy. So a lot of websites will have this live streaming function embedded in their site. And I think that's what's also kind of hurting the whole thing too, because if you're shopping for something in a live stream space, you want to flip through the rooms very easily. Like if I don't like this, I'm going to flip, it goes to the next thing. If I don't like that, I go to the next thing. If I like this, I bought it, and then I'm kind of bored watching this one, I flip to the next one. So that's where I think TikTok live streaming is really good for, is it has that variability. Whereas a lot of these other platforms, especially if you're hosting on your website, it's almost like a live show or a more stickier engagement for your viewers or your users, but it's harder to transact.
That's the best answer I've heard so far.
But I think it's definitely one of those new trends that is worth investigating into, because like you said, everything else is just so saturated. I think there's some things to say in terms of in the world of investing too, is when people zig, you zag. So when X is being super saturated, you better find something else that is a little different and a little easier to compete with. So I think while live streaming is where not as many people is going after this pie, the first people to do it or the early adopters will probably see some sort of return in the beginning. So in terms of looking ahead in the world of e-commerce, what sort of emerging trends are you seeing that's taking off or that you've seen that is a harbinger of the future?
I would say one of the biggest ones is AI. And I'm really curious to see how Alibaba incorporates AI, especially into like such an important point of like product development and ideation around products. But I think AI, the way you create a listing, you're going to have to create it with somebody buying and the way they search for something completely changing. So it's going to impact every aspect from the way the product's created to how your product assortment. So AI.
Do you use any AI tools for your own business?
Outside of ChatGPT, I have some subscriptions, but that's really the main one that I use. And it's mostly for a lot of the writing side of what we do or for brainstorming things. I used to have somebody that would work for the company around me. I would jokingly refer to it as a sounding board. So I need somebody that I can like bounce ideas off back and forth and that can give me some feedback on them or other ideas, even if it's just to shoot them down because it forces me to defend my point. I'm able to do that now with ChatGPT and with voice. So a lot of that. But the rest of them, I'm really far behind when it comes to like the imaging and what you could do. I see other people doing it. I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. But no, just ChatGPT. Yourself?
I use ChatGPT heavily. I really think that the number of queries I'm giving into ChatGPT is netting them a loss in profit just from my usage. But hey, their business model is $20 for unlimited. So here I am using it. The voice thing is very handy. Sometimes, like when my question is too long and I just can't type the whole thing out, I speak into it for sure. A really fun one that I discovered in the music creation world, and I don't know how I'll tie this into the work that I do, is Suno AI. So I'm not musically gifted, but you can choose any sort of music genre, write whatever lyrics you want or not. You just tell them, I need to create this type of soundbite for this usage, and they will go ahead and create that for you.
That's wild that you said that, because I didn't even think about them. And one of my businesses that I have is a brand called Salsa Kings, and it's a lot of dance studios for adults to learn how to dance salsa, bachata. And one of the issues we ran into where the music one that you mentioned uses, people don't want to dance in the class. They want to dance to like the most current beats, not these older public domain beats that you can get. But if we record the class and we try to put it on a stream, we'll get hit with IP issues. But now we're able to get these songs and go into this AI and say, create something with the same type of lively beat that we use in a dance class. We haven't deployed it yet, but we started cranking out a whole bunch of these songs that like we're almost going to have our own music now that we could use in class and that won't get us an IP issue when we stream it.
So any lasting words of advice for people, say if there's somebody that newly showed up in one of your meetups, what would you say to them?
Just get started. Figure out what your goals are. There's so many different opportunities right now to start a business. You're more than welcome to reach out to me for advice. I think everyone feels like they're in a unique position that what we're talking about only applies to somebody else or why it doesn't apply to them. I'd love to be on the other side of that and debate it with the person and brainstorm a way that it could help them wherever they're at. And I guess the only other one is if you listen to podcasts and you love hearing stuff like this, or if anything I said, any kind of sense, check out the Wizards of Ecom podcast.
Thanks so much. B2B Breakthrough is produced by Alibaba.com. To find out how Alibaba.com is empowering its customers with the tools, services, and resources they need to grow their businesses, visit Alibaba.com. And then make sure to search for B2B Breakthrough Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. Make sure to follow us so you don't miss future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Alibaba.com, thanks for listening.